Succession number 21564, Reel 12.
Colonel Cormac, Reel 12. Could you tell me what the strength of the boy squadron was when you arrived and what it was when you went on?
Well, it was growing steadily, and say just 100 to well over 100 at that time, and then it was growing to 150, nearly 200, and that was when they decided that the organisation would need to expand and improve even further, because it was a fairly rudimentary squadron call with three troops of boys, each with a sergeant in charge. I had another young man as 2IC and one other officer. Mm. And the education side for the Army Certificates of Education 1, 2 and 3, that was done by REEC sergeants. And then as things got bigger, an officer came in and to improve that. And later on, we had the addition of a very nice lady from the WRVS, which it became, to add a sort of motherly touch. Mm. As they perceived the needs of boys to be slightly more than just barrack room routine and so on.
How old were the boys when they joined you?
I think 14, thereabouts, because they had 2 or 3 years to do. It varied a bit. There was a bracket, I think, 14, 15, and then they could serve until they were 17 and a half before they went to man service.
What was on the syllabus of training that you provided for them?
Basic military training. Drill on the square was a prerequisite to get them formed up, and the idea of wearing uniform and being uniform. Physical training, PE, was very important, as indeed were games. And we concentrated a lot on games, mainly soccer and boxing were the two very popular sports. And then the education took up a great chunk of time, 45% of the time was in education, to give them that grounding which would enable them, if they developed as NCOs, to get to the top ranks up to warrant officer.
Do you know what was on the educational syllabus? Was it standard school subjects?
It was pretty elementary. English, arithmetic, a little bit of history and geography. It was, I have to say, pretty rudimentary. But that improved that as the thing went on, and people realised the potential here of sound NCOs and possibly what we now call late entry officers that might arise. And that was a steady growth, a steady improvement of facilities and standards.
Did you actually have to select them as well as looking after them and training them, or was the selection for your squadron done somewhere else?
That was pretty well done for us when they went to recruiting. Then the personnel selection officer system came into operation, and that was when they would be either asked what they wanted or whether they showed an aptitude. And the sappers were particularly popular because they most people knew or had some idea that at one point when they got to man service, they would be given the chance of trade training. And those who had gone the slightly different route of army apprentices were already earmarked for that. But the boys that we got were ones that had not got sufficient aptitude but might develop. But in any case, would get a chance for trade training, which would stand them in good stead later on.
And you were saying that some of these boys had got themselves into trouble. Did you have to take any special measures to keep them under control and disciplined?
No. No, they were all, well, they were all boys, and as such had all the troubles and problems that you get when a crowd of boys together.
Yes.
But I don't remember anything out of hand. Boisterous behaviour, I don't recall any real instances of bullying or brutality, which one hears about. I think a certain amount of... There were the usual initiation ceremonies, but they were fairly mild, and the NCOs, who were fairly experienced, kept a pretty close eye on that. Mm. And we didn't want boys put off because of that. And I think that sort of corrected itself. any instance like that. We didn't have anything desperate. There were none of the boys that I knew got into trouble subsequently. In fact, you couldn't really tell, but from the records, that they had ever been in court. They seemed to reasonably quickly absorb the system and even begin to enjoy it.
What would you do with them at the weekends? Would those be taken up by games or other organised activities?
That was the difficulty. Church parades were the order of the day then, of course, and they had to go to church. And then they would have padre's hours.
Yes.
The padre took a very active part in looking after them. And they had games, but there was time out and there was occasional chance to go to the families. We started a system because when I first arrived, they all wore uniform, and it was the old pre-war uniform with brass button jackets, heavy khaki serge, and khaki flat caps. That was how they were dressed.
Puttees?
No, they had gone away from puttees, but that was it. I started as the thing got more saying they could wear civilian clothes. If they earned the right. And that was very popular. But it was a uniform. They had to have black shoes, grey flannel trousers, white shirt, sapper tie, and blue blazer. All of which involved expense. One had to be careful. But it did work, and it was something they looked forward to, because then they could walk out or go home and leave. And they looked very smart. And I think they felt that. But they had to wait. It wasn't something they got automatically. They had to earn the right for that and so on. And I think that helped a bit to give them pride in the thing. And the sapper tie was a key feature. And many of them, and sergeants, messes, corporals, messes and so on, would be seen wearing the same clothes.
Did you lose any of them, or were you able to keep all your recruits and push them through into...
I think one or two failed physically.
Yes.
There were one or two who really would never make it, but we preferred to persevere for as long as we could, give them every chance to make good.
What was the role of your WVS lady? You said that she provided a sort of motherly atmosphere.
Yes, would talk to them, and they knew perfectly well if they had a problem that they didn't necessarily want to go to their sergeant or even come to ask me about, that they could go to her and that she would listen sympathetically. And it depended so much on the lady concerned. But they were, by and large, very nice ladies who were really interested in helping the thing along and looking after the boys. They were a very nice bunch.
Were you able to take them out on field exercises?
A little bit of that. We had an annual camp on the Isle of Wight. That was a tradition that we all got into a train and went down to the Isle of Wight and had 2 weeks there. And there they lived in tents, bell tents. They had to fill their own sleeping palliasses with straw and learn how to operate as a unit, looking after themselves and doing their own. Well, we had a cook or two with us, but that was how they would operate on their own. And then they did a bit of shooting, a bit of field craft, that sort of thing, in a training camp environment, away from the barracks. And I think that was very popular. And, of course, they were not far from Bembridge, and there was a beach nearby, and there was swimming, nice facilities, and given good weather, that was very successful.
What happened to you then after the dealing with the juniors? What was your next?
Well, move? After the as the squadron was expanding, and as I say, they decided to put a major in charge and buff up the establishment.
Yes,
a captain, two IC, and a troop officer with each troop instead of just one and three troop sergeants. I stayed in the same barracks and moved to a training squadron. It was the driver training squadron. Gibraltar Barracks, and I was there for, I suppose, about a year, and just during a routine training squadron 2IC, running the imprest, doing administration and that sort of thing. I didn't have much active hand in training, although I did get out and see them training and involve myself in vehicles as much as I could, because it was a good opportunity to buff up your own driving and so on. But that was just a quiet year, and then I was posted across the canal in Aldershot to Mons Officer Cadet School as an instructor. And there I spent three very happy years helping to train National Service officers.
How did the syllabus that you taught to these National Service officers at Mons compare with what you had learned at the Royal Military Academy?
Well, the system was that the chap would pass his selection board, and then he would come to Mons, and we handled all the arms. That's the gunners, the sappers, the Royal Armoured Corps, and I think one or two. No, they were and signals, and REMI, yes, the main arms and services. But the infantry and the ordnance and one or two others all went to Eton Hall.
Yes,
that was basically the infantry one. So we had them for 6 weeks, and we had to give them basic training again, field craft. Weapon training, map reading, current affairs, and leadership training. And you had 6 weeks to assess them and write a report on them, and before they went on to their arms school. And all the sappers in would come to Chatham, would have gone to Chatham to the cadet squadron there, the gunners likewise. So it was basic training with an emphasis on leadership. And they had to take their turn. We gave them responsibility for as much as one could. As an instructor there, I had a class or a group or a course, and I had myself and a sergeant. That was all we had. And about 30 cadets. So you had to learn who they were pretty quickly, which, again, you got into the habit of doing after a while. For example, every classroom, they had the same seating. They all sat in the same place, and I had a photograph of them with them in that position. So you quickly learned row three would be brown, and you made certain they didn't muck around by changing places. So you had to get to know them pretty quickly. Then it was a matter of... classroom lectures on map reading, where they would play an active part as and when they could, and ask them to explain how a compass was operated and see how they got on. Then there were lecturettes, which they all had to give a lecturette, and they would choose any subject they like, and they had 10-15 minutes to talk to the class about that. Well, you assess what they had to say. A lot of training out in the field. Section leading and platoon leading, and it was usually section attacks, platoon attacks, night map reading exercises, and sort of orienteering type things that you ran. That was a sort of mixture of general military training that went on.
It sounds like it's almost a concentrated form of what you had done.
Yes. With only 6 weeks to do it.
But with rather more in the field, proportionately.
At least half of it was in the field, yes. Mm. And then there were lots of room inspections, that sort of thing, and then parades, and culminating in the final pass-off parades. There was a class drill competition, which was thought to be very important in those days, and that took a bit of time, and that was reflected on your troop sergeant, your corps sergeant. He was responsible for that, and so on. But one got to know a great number of people, and then at the end of 6 weeks, you had to forget them all and learn a new batch and start all over again.
Was there a gap between courses for you to recover from this succession?
What happened, really, was that they would pass out on the Friday, and the next course would come in on the Monday. Mm. And then you would perhaps do two or three courses like that, and then you would have a six-week gap.
Yes.
And that would give you a chance to take leave, write up notes as necessary, do more lesson plans, or any other thing and that might be useful. And at the same time, we all took a part in running the school. I mean, I ran the rugby team. Mm. That was my game and my strong point, which was very rewarding because you got to know the boys then.
Roughly how many would you have in an intake? How many classes of 30 would you have running parallel?
Oh, it was quite death. There were three companies, and there would be three or four, 10, 12 groups at one time. The thing about Mons is that the armoured corps and the gunner cadets stayed there.
Yes.
They went to a different wing. I mean, the armoured corps went to G Squadron, which was in Mons, but they were slightly separate, and you moved your accommodation. The gunners also stayed, and others went to railway signals, went to Blandford, Sappers, to Chatham, and so on. So you could see one or two of them a bit later, but we had no hand in those. But the games was a good way of getting to know them.
What was the failure rate then?
Very small. Very small. Occasionally a chap got back squatted and had to repeat the course. That would be one or two. And then he wouldn't be failed until he'd done that.
Yes.
So I suppose one or two from my platoon, from my group, would might have to do it again. Not always.
Did you have formal tests, or did you make a judgment of their ability by impression?
The field training was all, I had just my mill board with what they were doing and notes at the time. Then you had to assess that. They had a map reading test, and that sort of thing. They did a bit of a signal training, which was marked. Yes, it was a mixture of informal notes in the field and tests, but all added together. And then you put that onto a report form with a paragraph at the bottom giving your impression. Pretty standard sort of stuff.
Would I be right in supposing that when they arrived at Mons, they had already done service in the ranks and they had done basic military training, so that their skills like fieldcraft, weapon training, map reading would have been developed?
Yes, that's true. They had done their basic training and what we used to call their core training.
Yes.
And then they had gone to a War Office Selection Board, a WASB, and obviously passed and posted on. Mm. So the emphasis on our training was leadership and doing things. It was not just having material thrown at you. You had to play, or we had to make them play an active part in it. And where possible, you see, you would go through a certain aspect of map reading, then you would ask one or two of them to come out and put that across and make them play a part, as opposed to, as their other rank experience, when they would just be sitting there and be told and then have to go and do it. The emphasis was on bringing them out and hearing what they had to say and how they would say it, and also giving them confidence.
While you were dealing with these classes, did you ever spot potential regulars amongst them? People who you would have encouraged to think of becoming permanent regular officers rather than national service?
Not really very often. In 6 weeks, it was difficult. That would happen when they went to their arms wing. That was where most of that would be done, yes. Mm. I mean, if the chaps were outstanding, you would say so. And then let the arms wing take it up. Mm-hmm. It would be too soon, I think, at that stage. But you might, in casual conversation, if a chap was really outstanding, say to them, you know, have you thought of making this a career, and what do you think? Mm-hmm. Or feed the idea, but no more than that.
What do you think was their main reason for wanting to be National Service Officers? Because it's a sort of temporary status, isn't it, if you're a National Service Officer and then you come to the end of the National Service and you leave and you go back into the civil life. What was driving them?
Difficult to be specific about that. I think most of them felt that this was a natural progression. That their schooling, their education, family background, experience, or such as it was, that they would thought this is, and their family expectations would say this is, you know, what I would expect to happen. I think one or two were frankly surprised that they got that far. I didn't meet anyone that I can recall who really didn't want to be there, because he wouldn't really have passed his
he'd have had to apply for the WASB, wouldn't he, to be there.
He had to there, or be recommended by his unit. He would be graded OR1, you see, by the PSO when he joined, when he was called up. That was OR1 as potential officer.
Yes.
OR2, potential NCO. That sort of thing. OR3, well, he's going to be a driver or a dog's buddy. It was that sort of rough and ready system.
Yes.
But all those who were OR1 would be, the CO would have a note and to watch them. And if they lived up to their billing, they would be given the chance to go to a WASB, unless they said, no, I don't. I think some of them felt that if they were an officer, they might get a more interesting posting, or they might get a better job, or it might help them when they left the army. There were a multitude of reasons for that. One or two eventually did become regulars, yes. Some would take short service and some would become regular. But not too many, but there were some.
I mean, could you spot those who were likely to do that when they arrived? How long did it take you to really form an opinion of their quality once you got them?
It that sort of thing speeded up as your experience grew.
Oh.
I mean, the first 6 weeks I thought was a hell of a long time. I'll never get to know all the names. By the time I'd been there a couple of years, I was much practiced in learning names and faces, and I had more practice at assessing people. And like anything else, you got better at the job, better as you went along. The more experience, and then you knew what you were looking for, perhaps slightly better than you were at first. Because, again, you were posted there. You met the commandant, and you were posted to a squadron. You met the squadron commander and talked to the other instructors who'd been there a bit before, and that was it.
No real induction, no formal
induction. Not really.
Induction.
You might, if you were lucky, you might have sat in on one or two periods. Mm-hmm. That varied a bit. Mm-hmm. You just picked it up as you went along.
Did the syllabus or methods of instruction change as time went on?
Not in my 3 years. No, mm-hmm. That didn't change. The only thing one could say is the emphasis would change slightly with a different commandant,
mm-hmm.
who might have slightly different ideas, or a different chief instructor who would say that he wanted more emphasis on this and that. But the syllabus as such, I don't recall changing at all. The only variation I had was in the training was one very good course I had. Instead of doing the full 6 weeks, I was told that your group are going up to Scotland, and you're going to go around the major training areas in Scotland and give demonstrations on firepower and section leading, and section the attack. And I thought this was a super idea. So, it took me back up to Scotland. So we did an abbreviated course and covered the essential ground, and I cut out map reading, and I cut out this and that and the other things, and concentrated on their weapon training, range procedures, section the attack. And I said to them, this is what we're going to do. Now, the school will make the basic arrangements, and you, in turn, they all had to do platoon commander, platoon sergeants, in a normal sort of way. You are going to have to do this for real. You are going to be responsible for getting these boys to the station, up to London, across London. The seats are all booked. You better get them on the train and up to Perth and so on. And I had done a recce beforehand, obviously, and worked it out. But they had to do that for real. And if they got it wrong, they wouldn't arrive at the right place. And at each of the training areas we went to, I had a script which they worked to, and I did the commentary, and we had rehearsed that. And I would do a running commentary on the thing, you know, the standard thing of a loudspeaker, and it was for all the CCF schools in Scotland. Yeah. And we went to Monifieth near Dundee, We went to Black Dog, north of Aberdeen, and we went to Coltibragan, which I knew well, north of Cymru, which is up in Perthshire. So we had to move around quite a bit. And they thoroughly enjoyed that, because they could see they were doing a real job, as opposed just to being company commander for the day, which they knew they would have to do and they knew they had to shine, and it was slightly artificial. This was something for real, and if they got it wrong, the system would break down.
Closest thing to soldiers, I suppose, that you could give them.
Yeah. And that was a very happy course indeed. Mm. And they all did extremely well. That was a one-off thing. But it just shows what happens when you change the routine.
Mm. Give responsibility early as well.
Yeah. Mm. It that was a very happy course. And they did enjoy that.
Were you happy with the overall quality of the people coming in? Did you think that they were up to scratch as platoon commanders?
Oh, yes. I thought, I had no doubt that most of them would make perfectly adequate officers, and given the next lot of training and the bit more experience, yes. There were one or two doubtfuls, but they tended to be people who were perhaps, not being derogatory, but going to the ACC, where their powers of leadership wouldn't be quite so strained. But most of them would do the job perfectly adequately. And as I had found before, the National Service soldier in Korea was indistinguishable from the regular. The National Service officer, we had a few of those in Korea, the only way you could distinguish him from the others was he was slightly younger and slightly less mature. But they tended to pick it up very well.
Yeah. While you were in Mons, the Suez affair blew up in 1956. Did that have any impact on you at the time?
We had extra jobs to do. There was a thing called the Glass House in Aldershot, the old military prison, which that had gone. But that was yours as there was a lot of stores coming in and transit of stores and things, and we had to take on responsibility for guarding that and inspecting it, and as orderly officer you had to go around and check that that was all right. But by and large it didn't interrupt our routine too much, because it was thought to be important to keep the system of going. It affected others more. But it had an impact in as much as some of them thought, well, maybe we're going to do something for real. But at the same time, a lot of them went out to Malaya, where they were involved in operations, because the Malayan campaign went on. Certainly until well after I left Mons. And so for many of them, there was a chance to go out to Malaya or Suez or similar for real excitement. Others, it would be either a UK posting, and then they might even go to a training unit and go through the sausage machine or go to BOR to the cycle of exercises there. A wide variety of places for them to go to in those days.
When they arrived at Mons, had they already been allocated to particular arms or services?
Yes, they were. They were all badged.
Yes.
They wore their sapper badge, their gunner badge, or whatever, as appropriate. Yeah. So that was known.